Next up is what I call a primer, and Michael Shirley calls a primer, on semen status. We both refuse to look up the pronunciation because we enjoy that mark of distinction. This is a fundamentalist principles, fundamental principles of how we tell who's a semen. I mentioned that briefly in passing in my earlier remarks. Two presenters, Daniel Knight at Chamberlain Herdlicka, and Jeremy Newell at Stevenson and Murray. Daniel is a UT product, BA in Government 2000, JD 2003. He comes, therefore, presumptively as a well-credentialed, competent lawyer and has shown it in his practice in a variety of ways. I won't go through the details, but he's got wide expertise in this field. He's a Texas super lawyer, among many other things. Jeremy Newell, whom I am just meeting for the first time, is an Aggie with the U of H Law Center, so his presumptive skills are not that high. But I've been told by people I know at Stevenson and Murray that he's a terrific, top-notch litigator and analyzer of cases. He's done a tremendous amount of very effective work. He's broadly credentialed professionally and otherwise, and it's going to be a treat to hear from both of you. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll say, in Jeremy's defense, that he is probably the most determined plaintiff's lawyer I know. And I mean that he and I don't always get along, and anyone who's from our firms know that. We've had our problems, like Judge Costa alluded to earlier, but I respect him, and so it's a treat for me to be able to have a discourse with him about this. This is a very basic issue in our practice, semen status. What is interesting, though, is that even though one would think with all of the Supreme Court decisions from the 1990s and with all of the subsequent intermediate appellate courts, even state courts chiming in, that we would have absolute certainty on this issue. However, it may just be an issue where absolute certainty can never be achieved. What we'll talk about today very briefly, a brief history leading up to the 1990s quartet of cases. I'll talk about the history part. Jeremy will talk about those cases and the current state of the test. And then we picked three issues where there's still a lot of room in the margins, we think. One is the limits of the 2014 Naquin decision from the Fifth Circuit. The second is terminating a semen aboard a vessel, which is actually an issue that seems small, but Jeremy and I actually litigated it against each other. So we already had the briefing. It was easy to write the paper, so that's an issue. And the third thing is what I call crews of FSOs and FPSOs, which are specialty vessels that are more common in the industry. Where do they fall with respect to people working on them? Would they be seamen in the service of a vessel? So this is Justice Joseph Story. He's probably the most cited jurist from the 1800s in the admiralty field because of his decision in Hardin versus Gordon, where he has several long passages about seamen and how pathetic they are and how they're friendless, lonesome creatures that are prone to all sorts of bad habits, essentially. One could say it was like most of my friends in law school. It was like a seaman, but that's a different story for a different day. Nevertheless, his opinion, Hardin versus Gordon, when he was riding on the circuit, which is an old term where Supreme Court judges actually had to go out and ride around to towns and hear cases and hear minor disputes. Some academics even say that our judges could do that and should do that now. I'd pay money to see Antonin Scalia ride the circuit. That would be entertaining to me. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, too. Nevertheless, while he was riding the circuit, he decided Hardin versus Gordon and held that a seaman deserved protection of admiralty and should get maintenance and cure. Another lesser-known judge, who I found interesting because of familiar connections, is Arthur Conkling Cox Sr., who was originally a New York district judge, then appointed to the Second Circuit. His son was also a federal judge. His grandson adapted Billy Budd to a Broadway-winning play. So, but this judge, Cox Sr., is important because of a decision that's cited in the paper where he actually used the term wards of the court to describe seamen. And he gives a similar rationale. There's nobody to protect these people. They're out there in the middle of nowhere. The courts have to protect them because they are pathetic, sad creatures who labor with their hands. And these are two cartoons I found that sort of explain. These are from the 1930s, actually. And you see you have a first mate here with a hook for a hand and a flapjack, or a shillelagh, as it may be called in some circles, ready to beat this person for not signing his seamen's articles. This is another cartoon, not even knives and forks, but if you can see at the bottom here, it's talking about where they live. The food is sickening. Forecastle is foul, unventilated, and alive with vermin. I only see one vermin in there, the little rat, but oh, yeah, something's behind there. Oh, there they are. Yeah, he's checking it out. These are from the 1930s. So even less than 100 years ago, this is how people in the general public, or at least this illustrator, viewed semen. So you could see a basis for the need to have protection for them. And this is Oliver Wendell Holmes in the case of Haverty, Supreme Court decision. It's mentioned in the paper. He wanted to expand the concept of semen status. This is post-passage of the Jones Act, to include more people who normally would be considered longshore workers. Justice Holmes was a very policy-driven jurist. You could analyze it like this. There's really little protection on a national scale for longshore workers. There is now protection for seamen. The workers need protection, so let's give it to them by making them seamen. Congress said, no, we're just going to pass the Longshore and Harbor Workers' Compensation Act and say a master and member of crew of a vessel is not a longshore worker, the statutory definition at the time. The problem is that led to a bunch of Supreme Court cases where the tail was wagging the dog. And they're sort of outlined and summarized in the paper as well. You had the court was deciding who was a seaman based upon who was a longshore worker or not a longshore worker receiving coverage under the act. It was a very circular situation, and it ultimately led to a two-part test. And the important part was, have a connection to a vessel, and do they aid in the navigation of the vessel? That's where it boiled down. Then in 1958, 1959, the Supreme Court, if you've seen The Godfather Part II, took omerta, vow of silence, if you will, and said nothing on the issue of seamen status for four decades, essentially, leaving the lower courts to decide who is and who is not a seaman. This is who I think is a seaman, because I was a latchkey kid in the 1980s, and Gilligan's Island was on reruns of WGN and TBS every day. So, you know, this is a guy who had a verbally abusive master on a clearly unseaworthy vessel, insufficiently crewed, no navigation system, no emergency communication. This man deserves protection, even though he's very happy and he's living on a desert island with a movie star. This is who my wife wants a seaman to be, Thor, Chris Hemsworth. Now, Thor would not be a ward of the court, in my opinion, because he has a magic hammer that lets him fly away from any problems he may have. I keep telling her this is not what it's like, and she just wants to talk about Thor. I don't know why. So I want to focus on two cases. There's a bunch of different cases, mainly in the footnotes in the paper, where we talk about the breakdown of the seaman status after the Supreme Court takes omerta. The first major decision is a year after that, and it's authored by Judge John Minor Wisdom of the Fifth Circuit. It's the offshore company versus Robeson, that test, which ultimately, as Jeremy will explain, became the seaman status test, or a big part of it. The case is treated in the paper. I don't want to crunch Jeremy for time, but I'll say the important thing to remember about this is The Fifth Circuit test was an inclusive test. It's a test that is looking not to aiding in navigation, but but it's looking to, are you furthering the purpose and mission of the vessel? And if you look back at Justice Story, if you look back at Benedict in the middle 19th century, they're saying the same thing. It's any person on the crew, not just the person at the helm, not just the person steering or doing the rigging. It's anybody who's there. This test tracks that language because, as Professor Robertson stated in an earlier paper, more eloquently than I, he didn't read just the holdings. He actually read the analysis of the cases. So there's a second lesson there. Actually read the decisions. You may find they're completely wrong. On the opposite scale, and here's an example, this tall gentleman here is Harlington Wood Jr., who authored the Johnson decision mentioned in the paper from the Seventh Circuit. This is actually a picture of when Judge Wood, when he was in the Department of Justice, negotiated with the wounded knee sit-in in the 1970s. He was the icebreaker who went in and eventually got that situation resolved. As a result, he was appointed to the federal bench. And he also played Abraham Lincoln in plays. So, and he sort of looks the part. Very big Lincoln fan. So that test, the Johnson test, wanted a bright line. And in the opinion, Judge Wood analyzes the Robinson test. And he says that it's too broad. We need to have a bright line. The bright line is, do you aid in navigation? Now, there were five or six different circuits that at one point in time had the bright line aid in navigation test, and the Fifth Circuit is over here by itself. And earlier there was discussion of, is the Fifth Circuit going to give up the ghost because all the other circuits are against it on utmost good faith? Well, they didn't give up the ghost, and as a result, as Jeremy will explain, that became the standard that was adopted. So maybe they shouldn't. Maybe they should just stick to their guns on that and see what happens. The interesting thing was Judge Wood's opinion was persuasive enough for, I believe, six Fifth Circuit judges when the court was sitting en banc in 1986 in Barrett v. Chevron to actually dissent and say, no, we need to follow the Seventh Circuit. They make sense. So there's a clear discussion and a clear separation. And at that point in time, the Supreme Court breaks its vow of silence, and Jeremy will explain that.
How many cases would you say that we've had over the years together?
At least 30 or 40.
Okay. And I can recall between him and the other members of my firm who are here who have handled these kinds of cases, I think we've had one dispute over seaman status in that time.
Right.
So other people may litigate that a lot, but between us, we haven't had that dispute arise that much. That's why we're here today to talk primarily about one of the issues, which is what happens when a seaman is terminated. Is he still a seaman as he departs the vessel and eventually reaches land, or does the moment he becomes terminated, does that end his status as a Jones Act seaman right then and there? And then subsequent to that, gets injured. So that's what we're going to talk about later, and that's what this is all leading up to. But basically the test, which Professor Robertson, I think, wrote in his paper that he presented today on seaman status, he has a problem with the phrasing that a lot of the courts use about when is a seaman a seaman. In other words, what does the seaman have to satisfy in order to become a seaman? And you'll see district courts and circuit courts all over the map on that. But our paper focuses on the current test, which was developed in four cases over the course of the 1990s after the Congress, when they initially – I'm going to let you operate that. When the Jones Act was passed, they didn't define the term seaman, so it was left to the courts to determine and define what is a seaman and what is not a seaman. The first case, which was decided in 1991, it was a unanimous opinion written by Justice O'Connor. That was the Wielander case. She decided, and as well as the court in a unanimous opinion, said that a seaman, in order to be a seaman, does not have to aid the navigation of the vessel, but rather as long as they further the purpose of the vessel itself. And in that particular case, it was a paint foreman who was injured while painting on a boat, or a barge, if you will, painting the vessel. They found that the function of the vessel was to provide paint and other equipment to perform repairs on vessels and so forth. Therefore, he was contributing to the vessel's purpose, and therefore he was a Jones Act seaman. The second case, which was the Gisoni case, also decided in 1991, was also a unanimous opinion written by Justice White. In that case, a rigging foreman was injured at work while working on a platform used to repair ships. Again, the Supreme Court said he was furthering the purpose of the vessel, which was to repair ships, and therefore was a Jones Act seaman. And in that particular case, the important issue was that the seaman was a ship repairman and had received benefits under the Longshore Act. And in that particular case, the Supreme Court says that's not dispositive. You can have a particular job title in the Longshore Act but still be a Jones Act seaman, and that's what the Supreme Court found. The third case, which has been mentioned several times, I think, in both Professor Robertson and Professor Sterley's presentation, was the Chandris case decided in 1995. That was also written by Justice O'Connor. That is an important case because it disposes of the snapshot test. In other words, what was the seaman doing at the moment he or she was injured? That determines whether they satisfy the seaman status requirement. Instead, what Chandris says is that the connection must be both substantial in duration and nature, and it adopted the Fifth Circuit's 30% rule, which says you've got to look at all of the circumstances of the seaman's employment to determine whether they qualify as a seaman. And the service may be on more than one vessel as long as that vessel has got a common ownership. And then finally, the fourth case, which we talk about in our paper, is the Pappy case, decided in 1997. That was an interesting case, and the opinion was written by Justice Kennedy, and he held, in that particular case, the plaintiff, who had been injured while working, was hired out of a union hall and had several different short-term jobs out of the union hall, but never was subject to the perils of the sea, and therefore did not qualify as a Jones Act seaman. And so that was the sum total of the four cases that the Supreme Court wrote on during the 1990s, even though for decades they hadn't written on any particular issue related to seaman status. And so that's kind of the overview, if you will, of the seaman status test. And Daniel's going to talk about the next issue where that particular type of analysis using the current test is applied. And in the presentation, you'll see the current test. We've set forth some factors there. One of the factors that I thought was important in analyzing the factors of each case, almost every court goes into great detail to say that it's, unless the facts are undisputed, it should be an issue decided by the jury. And the second thing that I think is important is that both in the Chandris case and in the Pappy case, the justices went out of their way in dicta to say that a seaman status arises before a particular work day begins. It doesn't occur at some point later in the day when the assignment may change or when somebody gets fired, things of that nature. And as you'll see, there just hasn't been a lot written on what happens when a seaman has been terminated, and we're going to talk about that in more detail.
Right. One of the things that I was taught in law school, and I always come to this, and I have, it's like a acid flashback, but I never took acid because Professor Robertson and Professor Sterley were my professors in law school, and I took every class they offered second and third year. And I sit there and I listen to them go through the paper, and I'm like, I can imagine back to when I was wearing, like Birkenstock sandals or whatever was in fashion in 2001. And it's like hearing the same thing over and over again. Some things never change. But what they both taught me and what a lot of the other faculty at UT taught me is to ask why. Yeah, this is what the rule is. That's great. Why? Why is it that? And ultimately, it goes back to the liberal remedy of a seaman's action. And the liberal remedies afforded to a seaman by maritime law trumping a more bright-line rule, in my opinion. And I could be wrong. but where we see that come up is in the case, in the 2014 case, which I discuss in the paper, is Naquin. The Fifth Circuit decision there, it was a 2-1. Judge Davis wrote the majority. Judge Jones dissented. And in that case, you had a vessel repair supervisor working at a shipyard. And 70% of his time was working on repairing doctor moored vessels. 30% of his time is running a crane that's on land in the shipyard. The evidence, as described in the case, in the opinion, says that less than 1% of the plaintiff's time was spent working on a vessel when it was actually in motion, going from one, even from one slip to another in the dock. He gets hurt pretty severely while operating the crane on land. The crane essentially collapses while trying to lift a test block. A co-worker is killed. He witnesses it. The Fifth Circuit says he can't recover emotional damages for the death of a co-worker for witnessing it, and that gets but that's not at issue here. What is whether or not he was even a seaman to begin with, and the Fifth Circuit in a 2-1 says yes, he was. He spent 70% of his time working on vessels, but 69% of that, or 99% of that 70%, was spent on vessels that are tied up to the shore. The difficulty there is you're, and the case focuses quite a bit, especially Judge Jones's dissent, on the problem that comes with the inclusive test, is where does it stop? Where does it end? Have we gotten back to where Justice Holmes wanted us to be, where most longshore workers can be seamen? Or is there ever going to be some sort of a bright line point? And I would contend, just me, that Judge Jones, in her dissent, makes a very good statement. You know, and to quote her dissent here, the moving right along approach to the particulars of Naquin's employment runs contrary to the fact-specific inquiry that the Supreme Court has recommended for determining seaman status. And in that instance, we're trying to evaluate facts. And so, and Jeremy and I agree, this is a margin, this is an on-the-margins issue. Most of these things, there's going to be enough evidence one way or the other to go to a jury. So the question as a practitioner is, how do you develop the evidence? Where do you need to look when you're deposing the seaman, the alleged seaman, to establish facts that could be used in a dispositive motion if you want to do it? One of the ways is to establish that this person was not exposed to any significant perils of the sea from the Popeye, as I call it, decision from the Supreme Court. I like Popeye. So this is not a peril of the sea. Young love on the Titanic. It was a peril of my early college years because I just couldn't stand this movie. But it was always on. What is a peril of the sea, however, is the chance that your ships might run into each other or run into a dock, that you may have deep water or shallow water problems that could cause the ship to collide with a reef, for example, like the Costa Concordia. You could have some inclement weather issues, like an iceberg that causes your brand-new luxury liner on its maiden voyage to crack in half. Sea predators are a big problem. That's a peril of the sea, as Captain Hook can attest. Although a crocodile is sort of a marshy, not really straight salt water. Vessel fires. The Hyundai Fortune fire is one example of having to fight the fire at sea with no help from land-based firefighters is a peril of the sea. Abandoning ship can be a complicated process. That's a peril of the sea. Exposure to the elements. I went back to the Titanic well again. That's a peril of the sea. And being at the whim of a master, like in The Perfect Storm, who's going out into a certain death situation, and there's no way for you to get off the vessel, that's a peril of the sea. The paper collects both cases and other scholars who made a list of the perils of the sea. And this is not an exclusive list, but it's a pretty good list of things. And in the paper, I note that Naquin was possibly exposed to less than half of these at any point in his employment. And moreover, at the time of his incident, and I know we can't use a snapshot test, but there was none of them because he was on land. So what's the difference between Naquin, a guy who works on 99% of his time on a vessel as a moored vessel, and just a regular stevedore who's employed by somebody else? There's a lot of fuzziness there. And I think that's an issue that's going to be in on our dockets for some time in the near future. And it's unfortunate that Naquin, both parties tried to get cert, and both were denied. So the Supreme Court took a pass for now on the issue. There's another case that's mentioned in the paper, Southern District of New York case from 2013, so it was pre-Naquin, but it had almost identical facts and found the person was not a seaman. So there's going to be disputes about this. Eventually it will come up over time. I think, I'll yield to Jeremy for his comments on this issue, but I think that if you're going to go this route with the perils of the sea, I don't necessarily think it's a strong argument, because there's a lot of exposure to perils of the sea. But if you're going to do it, I would be asking about each one of these categories of things to the worker in their deposition and to their supervisor to try to establish something on the record that, have you ever been attacked by any sort of a sea predator, like the Kraken, a crocodile, anything of that nature? No. Check that off. Because since it is a fact-intensive issue, you need to have some facts. And I think part of the problem in the Naquin case was there weren't enough facts in the record because of the moving right along approach, just sort of glossed over it. Don't let the courts gloss over your situation. Do you have thoughts on that?
Just a couple of thoughts on that. I think that the significance of the – and I've represented a knock-in, so that's how I think that's how it's pronounced the Louisiana way. Nevertheless
– sorry, I taxified it.
That's okay. We all do that.
Yeah.
The issue in the knock-in case wasn't that I don't think that the reviewing court was trying to establish a bright-line test. I think what they were doing was what the standard of review requires in a Jones Act case, and that is – when a jury finds in favor of a seaman status, the reviewing court is to defer to that based on the facts of the case. And I'll agree with Daniel, there wasn't a lot of factual information contained in the case. But in my reading of the case, 70% of the work that this man did was actually on the water. Whether he was exposed to the perils of the sea to some degree or not isn't really the issue. Most Jones Act seamen that we represent are not exposed to attacks by sharks and alligators and so forth. These people don't have to survive a fire abandonment issue. It's the potential for having to contend with that that makes these people a Jones Act seaman. And we know from some of the cases in the 1990s that just because a particular job title is contained within the LHWCA, that does not foreclose the opportunity for a seaman to establish seaman status in a Jones Act case. So I would say that the majority in the Knockin case got it right. I've tried a case, and it was affirmed on appeal, the Salinas versus Weeks Marine case in San Antonio, where this similar issue was in effect in the fact that my client was carrying a battery on land when he was hurt. And in that particular case, the San Antonio Court of Appeals found seaman status, even though at the moment that he was carrying the battery, he was not exposed to the perils of the sea. He was not working directly on the vessel. He was simply transporting a battery from land to a dredge, and the court in that case found that there was enough evidence in that case to find seaman status. And so for that reason, it is, and you'll hear this refrain many times from us and from others, it is always a fact-intensive issue. And not to mention the fact that the Supreme Court and other courts for years have said that the issue of seaman status should be liberally construed in favor of finding seaman status. And I think the Knockin court did that in looking at the record and finding evidence of that.
The only thing that I'll add is the Alexander case that the professors mentioned in their discussion is a post-Knockin, or Naquin, case. Same judge authored both opinions. And Professor Robertson commented that it seemed to be a more rigid application. So maybe there is some ratcheting back. I don't know. I can't get inside the mind of Judge Davis. I'd probably be overwhelmed if I did. But nevertheless, there's at least some correction occurring, although it's on a slightly different issue of the 30% rule. We'll move on because we don't have a whole lot more time, only until 11:30. We want to keep everybody on schedule. 12 minutes. And this next issue is going to deal, it's going to be a little more, not heated, but in depth because we've actually argued it before. Terminating a seaman on a vessel. You're fired. And Jeremy will start with this.
Generally speaking, you would think that there would be a lot written on this particular issue, but when Daniel and I litigated this particular issue at the summary judgment stage, both of us scoured the landscape coast to coast and could only find a handful of cases, not even a handful of cases, where this issue was addressed. I found nothing in the Fifth Circuit addressing what happens when a seaman is terminated and then is injured after he or she is terminated. Does the fact of termination end the seaman status right then and there, or does it continue beyond that until the person safely reaches shore after his duties end? And so you can imagine what I argued in my case, and Daniel argued the latter and was able to persuade the judge to grant summary judgment in that case. But the issue in when a seaman is terminated, there are two specific cases that I think are addressed in the paper. The first is called the Michael Tracy case from 1924 out of the Fifth Circuit. The second case is called LeBlanc versus BGT Corporation out of the First Circuit in 1993. Both of those cases actually deal with the same issue that we dealt with in our case, which is a seaman was terminated and then was injured subsequent to the termination. And in both of those cases, the courts found that he would be entitled to seaman status based on the fact that the person who has been terminated, who has finished the voyage, needs to be provided the opportunity to be safely off the vessel before seaman status ends. In my particular case, and Daniel can give you his side of things, as we argued in the court, my particular plaintiff was working as a dredge captain. He was told by his supervisor that you need to leave the vessel, that you're fired from being a captain on this vessel. The plaintiff gets on essentially a dredge tender called a skiff and was in the process of being taken to shore when the accident happens. And it was our position in arguing that he was a Jones Act seaman, factors such as an incident report that the defendant prepared. There's a blank on the incident report form that said jurisdiction and the words Jones Act appear. Second factor was that my particular plaintiff continued to be paid for 3 days after the injury occurred. And there was also some evidence provided by the plaintiff at the summary judgment stage to indicate that there was some discussion between him and his supervisor about continuing to work on the vessel in another position, not as a captain. So all of those factors, there's some other things. There was a workers' comp letter that was sent to the plaintiff who said you have a work-related injury, and we could go on and on and on and on. But the point is, at least from my perspective, the decisions made elsewhere through the Michael Tracy case and through the LeBlanc case would indicate that there has to be some opportunity for the plaintiff or the seaman to leave the vessel before his or her Jones Act seaman status ends. Because using a ridiculous example, let's hope this would never happen, what would prevent someone from firing someone and then just throwing them overboard and saying, see you later? There has to be some opportunity to get off the vessel. One other fact of my case was when the plaintiff was taken off the vessel, he was taken to a company truck and then was transported home from the Houston, Texas area down to the Rio Grande Valley. So it would have been my position, had it come up, that his seaman status would not have ended until he was dropped off at home, because the employer was undertaking the obligation to transport him home from the location where the accident occurred all the way until he reached home. So that's kind of an overview. It's a quick overview of that case. We don't have a lot of time, and I do want to give Daniel an opportunity to talk about this case. One last thing I will say is we so vehemently disagreed on this issue that our argument continued in the elevator riding down from the courthouse.
It did. Not one of my finer moments. And I try to admit when I'm wrong, but it's hard because, like Trump, I'm very rarely wrong. You know, I'm huge. My thought on this issue was I thought it was a really interesting fact scenario to begin with. You have a captain who's fired by his shoreside supervisor, who, for reasons that aren't important to our discussion, got so mad at him. The supervisor got so mad at the captain that he drove from Port Lavaca, Texas at like 4 o'clock in the morning to Houston, found the dredge, got on it, and fired him, and then had him taken off. I think ultimately in the summary judgment stage, what worked to my favor were two things. One is a interesting quirk that can bite or give to plaintiff's attorneys who choose to file under the Savings to Suitors Clause. And it's the Penrod case from the Texas Supreme Court from 1993, which says that the only law that is binding upon a Texas state district court hearing a case in Admiralty. Supreme Court of the United States, Supreme Court of Texas, and intermediate Texas courts. So what the Fifth Circuit says, even if it's been precedent for 50 years, if a Texas court hasn't adopted it, it doesn't matter. It's secondary. It can be persuasive, very persuasive, but it's not binding. So my angle on it was I had to look for something in the Fifth Circuit which was silent on the issue to give me something where I could say, Judge, I think you're bound to follow this analysis. Because the Michael Tracy and the LeBlanc case were somewhat more on point factually, but they'd never been cited by any Texas courts. I think one of them had been cited by one intermediate appellate decision that was then reversed by the Supreme Court of Texas, so it didn't really count. So what I found, and this is in footnote 121 in the paper on page 14, are three cases from the early 70s that I'll call the Call of Duty cases and not the video game. It's the seaman has to be answerable to the call of duty in order to be in the course and scope of their employment. If you're fired, you aren't answerable to the call of duty of the vessel anymore. The employment relationship is severed. But a couple of those cases have been cited by Texas intermediate appellate courts, and so I think that was a big part in me having some actual possible binding authority, and plus the skill of my argument, that helped get it over the top. The other thing was, and Jeremy can attest to this because he normally doesn't object a lot in depositions, but I asked this guy 50 different ways in his deposition and made him admit that he'd been fired before it happened. Any conceivable angle I could get at to ask the question again. And then I made mention, I filed a supplement to the motion and said he admitted 14, 13 times in his deposition he was fired when this happened. How can you be in the course and scope of your employment, which the statute requires, if you've been fired? And so my thing was he has a remedy, and the remedy is a passenger negligence action under the general maritime law. If he did get hurt, which he claimed, he still has the right to sue for damages. He has maritime tort jurisdiction, but he's not a seaman. So if you want to add anything on that, we have one more.
The only thing I wanted to add on that is the Supreme Court has told everyone across the nation you cannot use a snapshot test. That's clearly what, in my opinion, this particular judge did. She said, Judge Kerrigan ruled, you know, in granting summary judgment that he wasn't subject to the call to duty at the moment of the accident. That's not the test you're supposed to use. And not to mention the fact that even though the plaintiff admitted that he was fired, what wasn't discussed in his deposition in any great detail was the conversation between his dredge supervisor and the plaintiff on the way to the shore that they were going to continue working on in other positions for the same dredge. And so the point in all of this is simply to say that every case that you work on where the seaman status comes up, in my opinion, as a plaintiff's lawyer or as a defense lawyer, you need to get into the facts of your case very deeply, the assignment, the length of the assignment, how long did you work on the vessel. The distinction between my case and a lot of these other cases that Daniel cited in the paper, subject to the call of the duty of the vessel, is the fact that my plaintiff never completed his voyage at the time that this accident happened and the time that he was fired, and he continued to be paid his normal wages up through the third day after this accident occurred, which would have completed his time on the vessel for that particular ship. So we could go on and on and back and forth. The point is, get into the facts of your case, understand exactly what the assignment was. Did he continue to get paid? And then, in my opinion, you also need to get into workers' comp documents that are sent, other documents that are sent by the defendant. How do they document the incident? Talk to everybody who was there and find out if there's an admission. In my opinion, it was not even a close call. When the defendant writes an incident report and for jurisdiction says the words Jones Act, to me that should end the analysis. I hadn't moved for summary judgment. The point is, the judge should have let the issue go to the jury for the jury's determination. And all of the Supreme Court cases talk about that only in the rarest circumstance should that issue be taken away. So that's all I have on that.
I'll just add on this that if your clients use a third-party administrator of any kind, or if you work for a third-party administrator, if you are a third-party administrator, you have to be careful about the routine letters and forms that are being sent on behalf of your clients or on behalf of your company, because they can create disputes that could lead to you paying – wait.
That sounds like an
admission.
Paying
a bunch of money. No, it's not an admission. It's just simply saying that – because I don't think that any of that stuff matters. But that headache could have been avoided. And so you as the attorney need to tell your client, hey, do this. We're out of time. We have a minute left. I'll tell you this. This is a dredge, Stewart v. Dutcher Construction. This is a ratty old houseboat in Lozman. We've seen this photo before. The former is a vessel. The latter is not. Those two cases redefine vessel status and sort of limit it to a reasonable observer test in Lozman. Now, what you have is a scenario where you have the Thunder Horse platform is not a vessel, yet it was towed out to sea and can, in theory, be towed again. You also have this, an FSO or FPSO, which is a ship that is converted into a refinery of sorts or even a production platform and then taken out into deep waters and moored like this to the actual seabed, much akin to a fixed offshore platform, which is not a vessel. But unlike those, this thing can have an engine and screws and can actually move. When oil goes back up, more of these will, I think, be at issue for the time with $28 a barrel oil or whatever it is. I think it's sort of a tertiary issue at this point. But I think that, you know, you're going to have a nice old-fashioned Hart and Sachs legal process argument by analogy, comparing and contrasting different types of structures. I put in the paper, it may even go back to the Robeson decision from Judge Wisdom, where it's a vessel under tow, but it's not a vessel here. I don't know that that really matters, but it could be a good point.
Any yeah, thoughts? And I think on these, very quickly, because I know we're ready for a break, on these cases, it's important, again, to get into the facts of the case. You need to find out what the vessel was built for, how long is it intended to be at this particular location. Is it going to move from location to location? How often is it going to move from location to location? And that, in my opinion, will determine whether it's likely to be determined that somebody injured on that particular structure is a seaman or not, based on what the vessel is intending to do. That's all.
Yeah. So if you have any questions, please feel free to email us. You can tweet me if you want. I have a Twitter account with, like, a bunch of fake bot followers. So that's cool. But thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.